And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie and a full house. I can't believe it. I used to do this program by myself for several years, but the program is now flooded with the fantastic connections of all these people who are in the studio this morning. G'day, Tobias.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. What about you, Hanila?
I'm pretty good. Happy to be here, even if I did almost lose, I think, a few fingers getting here. It is so incredibly cold.
I know. Lose my mind. It's so cold. And Matt. G'day, Matt.
Yeah, it's great to be amongst everyone in the studio and the listeners in the audience.
That's exactly right.
I would like to do the weather report this week, if that's okay.
Go for it.
It was so cold that when I got to my bus stop today, the glass of the bus shelter or Perspex or whatever it is to anyone fact-checking in the audience was completely frosted over to the point where I had to get a leaf off a tree and manually scrape all of the ice off of the panels so that I would be able to see my bus. And that is just not a normal occurrence.
No, it isn't. And of course, all those gardeners out there, let's hope you took the frost warning. Yes.
Well, what I'm really trying to say is I hope all of the audience out there feels deep pity for us having to get up in the middle of a very cold winter.
Oh, you're just
winter.
A sook. You're just
yes,
a
exactly.
Sook.
Well, and I hope everyone's in their nice warm houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listening to us on the radio.
And there could be some homeless people who are listening in.
Who have found a nice warm spot for the night, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully. We've got a lot of stuff going on around AI. It's really fascinating because Albo has finally come up with apparently a legislation that's supposed to curtail control AI.
Yeah, I think it was a speech on Wednesday Albo gave. Look, I just went through it fairly quickly during the week. But essentially, within his own department, the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, he has set up an AI department within the PM.
What is that, a closet with a chair and a table?
I think so, yeah. So it's just interesting that AI kind of just sprung out of nowhere, other than
data centers.
That's true. But it seems like it's the growth of data centers has just sprung out of nowhere, and AI has been foisted on us. And
I would actually say, Matthew.
Yeah.
I don't think it's come out of nowhere. I think there's been some scaffolding, policy scaffolding going on for the last couple of years.
There's been
some documentation and policy guidelines that were released in particular last year, where the government actually laid out all of their kind of policy goals around AI, and they were very explicit about the fact that their main priority is attracting investment in AI. And obviously, in very kind of voter-friendly terms, couching this desire for investment alongside an interest in preserving, you know, the rights of workers, and probably a sentence-long reference to the environment and things like that. But the bottom line has been that they are very, very interested in attracting international investment. And that's been the bottom line for at least a year now.
Oh,
but
it's
been
for longer than that, but
go
on.
The policy that you're talking about, Matthew, that they've been emphasizing this week, I think is a slight repackaging of something that they've had in the works for a long time now.
And also, as this is, it's because everything is at that level is actually manipulated as a political foxtrot, this as GetUp says, new rules or a green light. And this is what GetUp says. And this is, it says, after more than 1,800 GetUp members demanded the government introduce binding national rules to rein in the data centre boom, today the Prime Minister stood up and promised rules that are clear, consistent and mandatory, as if, you know, we've got it all under control. There's nothing to worry about. Don't scare the horses. But then we read the fine print. The Labor's new rules don't set a minimum share of renewable energy new data centres have to use or explicitly prohibit new gas. They don't limit the amount of water they can take, even as Sydney households face restrictions in the next drought, and they don't guarantee Australians a cent of the profits. In other words, the Prime Minister has given Big Tech a green light dressed up as AI in Australia's interest. The proposed laws go to National Cabinet next month, so now is a chance, they say, for people to actually put forward. Here's what we're up against. There are already 162 data centres operating in Australia with another 90 in the pipeline. The proposed Murray Road data centre in Western Sydney alone would be one of the biggest in the world. One company has plans to build enough data centres to lift Australia's entire electricity demand by around 60%, while another wants to build one of Australia's largest gas plants to power just one data centre site. The rules Labor set out today don't stop even more companies doing the same thing. And this is at the same time as the Liberal Party is peddling the notion of nuclear power.
I also think it's worth pointing out that there's already been a massive amount of investment from companies like Microsoft and Nvidia. So the bill's already been paid. So I think there's probably, I mean, not to discourage people from making a fuss about it and signing petitions and having their say, but I think that Matthew, I think, is right to point out that I think that there's been actually very minimal public consultation in the process of deciding that it's going to be a really central part of complexifying Australia's economy moving forward. Because diversification in the Australian economy has been a really big issue for a long time now. Like, we have a very unsophisticated economy for such a wealthy country. And I think that the government has rightfully tried to address that problem, but AI and developing technology around AI has become a really central part of that economic pivot. And I think that's something that makes sense because of the global context of what's going on. But as you've just explained, Annie, is going to have massive environmental and social impacts that really haven't been discussed openly with the public.
One thing about Albo's speech, did he talk about workers having some kind of control or say?
My main takeaway was him repeating the phrase, "We're doing it the Australian way," over and over again. But yeah, there was reference to needing to preserve the interests and rights of workers. And I think that that hasn't really been reflected in any of the policy that I've seen in terms of having a real structured approach to, for instance, including unions in the process of figuring out how AI is going to be implemented into workplaces and things like that.
Well, you see, ACT...
So I'm not sure what that means
in practice. The ACT was right behind the Labor government. As soon as the Labor government put out his statement... the ACTU put out a press release saying rah 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 rah. So obviously they're in line with the overall message. However, they have been doing stuff around the financial unions, and NTU are also in the thick of the issues that are related to the AI. But you found some information about a critique by Greg Jericho from the Australia Institute.
Yeah, Greg Jericho, I think he's there at the Australia Institute. He's the head of economic policy, and he put out an article on Deep Cut, and he pretty much went through line by line, kind of like Albo's speech on Wednesday. And he actually referred to some analysis by the head of the Productivity Commission, Danielle Wood, and pretty much set out that, you know, what the claims she was making about benefits in terms of productivity were just not there. Yeah. Yeah.
I think on a different program for 3CR, it's not Radiothon anymore, but still doing some spruiking about the benefits of supporting 3CR. There's a lovely range of programs that you can tune into, including Stick Together. And on a previous Stick Together program, I had a chat with someone from the Maritime Union of Australia, and they were saying very similar things, that there's actually very, and this has been supported by, it's been supported by Harvard, if you need a big brand name on your research to believe it, but...
Harvard, isn't their whole model based on case study type approach?
I wouldn't know, but basically they've supported the point you're making, which is that there's been pretty minimal evidence that introducing AI into workplaces actually has positive impacts for productivity, and it has a really negative impact for instance, workers' ability to be paid properly.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you should say that, because this is another side issue. At the same time, and I think this is one of the reasons for why this legislation or these ideas have been put into practice at the moment, to make people feel like everything's under control, even though these data centres have been being built outside Melbourne since the beginning of the year. If you'd been following the plumbers are all happening with the stuff that's going on the outskirts of Melbourne.
Another great reason to listen to 3CR all its programs.
Well, the thing about it is that they just thought that they could sneak it all in without anybody making a fuss, because this is affecting the outer suburban people in exactly the same way as the outer suburban people are affected by the incinerators, or what they like to call waste to energy. They've got all these great slogans, but really it's poisoning the air of the people who live right next door. And it's exactly the same as the stuff as with the data centres. And they thought they could just get this to happen without anybody noticing. But of course, the stuff that's been happening in America with the data centres we live in a global world now. People know what's happening to people in other places where they're being strong-armed by the oligarchs. And it's not just it's the oligarchs right across the world. And Australia obviously is open for business in the same way as Tony Abbott would have us believe, lying back there with, completely open to whatever happens. This business is about the Australian way. What are you talking about? I mean, what is it? The Australian way is come and steal the land and kill everybody who's here? Is that the Australian way?
And exploit resources that we are lucky enough to have plentiful amounts of without actually being responsible at all about managing these resources.
I mean, I remember in 1975 hearing an ABC program talking about how Australia was a great big hole in the ground. That's what Australia represented. Has anything changed?
Well, friend of the show, Maluma May, we had a excerpt of her speech that she delivered as part of a PhilEF event earlier in the year. We played it on last week's show of PhilEF. And she talks about Japanese gas giant INPEX and how in the heart of the city of Darwin, they've had a gas leak
it's been going on for
decades, and it's affecting birth rates and child health and just general community health. And this is the company that sponsors the only university that's in Darwin. This is the company that gets all the subsidies to export the gas and then resell it to the Australian market. This is what it is. Even reading the Deep Card article that you were saying, Matthew, there's a data center lobby group called Data Centers Australia. So every kind of company is represented by a massive lobby group that influences the government.
And that extent of lobbying really puts the question, are we really living in a representative democracy where vested interests, but just through money, get access to decision makers? That's really disturbing.
And you've got legislation that's just settling the horses. Oh, no, don't worry. Everything's under control. We're in suits. We speak in calm language. We're not emotional. In fact, a perfect example of this is that the Victorian Forest Alliance alerted people to. The Victorian government is moving to prioritise fishing and shooting over environmental protection. This is an explainer put out by the Victorian Forest Alliance.
Labor is trying to introduce a new super agency that governs the use of public land in Victoria. The reason this is a huge worry is that this body will prioritise and incentivise shooting and fishing over all the other activities that we enjoy in nature and over nature protection itself. The name of the super agency has been changed from Outdoor Recreation Victoria to Fishing, Hunting and Outdoor Victoria. That itself is pretty revealing. The proposed bill includes a land access panel. This will be chaired with people that the minister picks. It won't be disclosed who they are, and the advice and recommendations that they provide to the government also will be kept a secret. The Greens and Animal Justice Party have tried to get amendments to the bill so that this advisory panel includes traditional owners and expert ecologists. They've also tried to get amendments to strengthen conflict of interest rules, transparency, and also make sure that the agency is required to protect habitat and consider the impacts of activities on the well-being of wildlife. The Shadow Minister for Environment, Nick McGowan, has also been scathingly critical of this bill on similar grounds. Anyway, the government has rejected these amendments, but they have supported amendments from the National Party to remove the requirement of the board to include ecologists and wildlife biologists, but instead add hunting and fishing representatives. The shooting lobby is pretty thrilled about all this. Labor expected the bill to pass on June 18, but the debate went so long and there were amendments, so it has had to go back to the lower house. This will happen later this month or in early August, which does give us a little bit of time to make sure that our representatives know how we feel about this corrupt fuckery. Animal Justice Australia has a handy online action that you can use to contact decision makers, or if you prefer, you can just email or call your own MP to tell them that you expect new legislation to prioritise nature protection and transparent decision making over the interests of the hunting and fishing lobbies.
Well, I think that says it all. And before we move on, we'll have to mention that there's been a fair amount of outrage at the violence, obvious, clear deaths of at least four people last week. For
two women and two girls.
I was going to say like 13-year-olds being murdered. And business goes on as usual, because the push has been to show that there is you could call it a rape culture, effectively, and that you can have a phony royal commission financed by the Fed, public money, into anti-Semitism. Not that anti-Semitism isn't an issue, but it's one of the many issues in racism that pollutes our society.
And there's already on the books a very comprehensive anti-racism framework, which hasn't been adopted.
Exactly.
But also, on that similar note, we've seen that there's a national inquiry into the racism that's faced by First Nations people that's concurrently happening as the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion's carrying on, and it's received almost next to no
promotion.
Information or reporting or journalism or articles or anything like that, especially since it had as one of its central themes the daily threats and intimidation that First Nations people are reporting they have in their communities, especially as the Northern Territory government refused to front up to the commission. They just didn't turn up.
Yeah, disgraceful.
But I think we need to have our moment of addressing what's been going on this week in terms of violence against women. So two women and two girls have been killed this week. as a result of gendered violence. And I think it's becoming pretty clear that this is part of a much broader pattern that's been going on for a very long time. I think to the point you were making, Annie, this is a structural issue. It's not something that is going to be fixed by throwing money at it. We need to throw money at it, but we also need to have like a deep cultural change in our country about how men and women interact with each other and how men treat women. I think that to frame this conversation, one woman a week is killed on average every 9 days as a result of intimate partner violence. And this is happening at the same time that the Queensland government has just cut tens of millions
Good
of dollars
boys.
In funding and resources from its domestic violence response policy. There's clearly a very far way to come. And I think the least we can do is keep these women in our thoughts this week. And girls, they're not women. These children and these girl children and women in our thoughts.
I agree.
Woo! Thank you so much. Our final speaker is the woman they tried to silence. This Veronica Sherman was scheduled to deliver the lecture on Christian Zionism. She's a Jewish woman. She's actually an Israeli and served in the IDF, although she completely rejects the values that were carried at the time, and is a staunch supporter of Palestinian freedom. But she's a Jew, and they shut her down because somebody somewhere, almost certainly Jewish supporters of Israel, felt that her lecture on Christian Zionism was going to be too dangerous. Now, Veronica gave a talk, an excellent talk in the end, which ran for 40 plus minutes. She's promised me that she won't repeat that talk now. But if you do want to see her talk, and in fact all the talks in our seminar series, go to Anti-Zionism Australia on YouTube, and we also have, of course, an Instagram account. But all the talks in the seminar series are available to watch in the dry when you get home. So Veronica is our final speaker. Over to you.
Australian democracy is going extinct, and it's a death by a thousand cuts. Each small slice seems insignificant in itself, and the temptation is to look away and to think that it's not such a big deal, especially in the context of a genocide that rightly consumes our attention. But I want to share an experience I had in September last year. I heard that there was going to be a conference in the Gold Coast, something about combating anti-Semitism. Mayors and councillors from around Australia were invited to a three-day event with all expenses paid. Yeah. I was intrigued. Who organises a conference about anti-Semitism 2 years into a genocide? I reached out to different local groups, asking them if they were going to protest. Surely we couldn't just let this conference take place in Australia without opposition. I mostly had no responses, and the ones who did said we shouldn't be centering what's happening in the Jewish community. I attempted to explain that this was not about the Jewish community. This conference was a strategic and coordinated global plan to infiltrate our government, institutions, and local councils with Israeli propaganda. In other words, foreign interference. It fell on deaf ears. So I flew up to the Gold Coast by myself with no plan at all, except to hopefully bring back some evidence of this Israeli master plan. I dressed up as a Zionist, hoping that I might be able to join in the festivities. Despite the crazy heavy security and police presence, it worked. And I scored myself a show bag full of brainwashing propaganda that was handed out to our impressionable mayors and councillors. That evening, I was put in touch with the other activists who had come to protest. Guess how many of us were there? Five. Not 5,000 or 500, but five. Two from Canberra, two Queenslanders, and me from Melbourne. I remember so clearly the next morning, standing outside the hotel that was hosting the mayors and the councillors, holding my banner, watching bus after bus fill up with these suckers, and wondering, when will the impact of this conference reach me? The Gold Coast is far away from Melbourne. How long will it take? Because in the show bag, there were booklets outlining what is now considered anti-Semitic. It's almost laughable. Saying free Palestine is anti-Semitic. Saying Gaza is an open-air prison is anti-Semitic. Saying Zionism is Nazism is anti-Semitic. Even watermelons are anti-Semitic. And of course, according to this definition, accusing Israel of committing a genocide is anti-Semitic. All of these examples only highlight one thing. And that is that the meaning of what anti-Semitic actually means has been weaponized by the Zionists, in the same way that the Holocaust has been weaponized by the Zionists. But back to my question, as I stood holding my banner in the Gold Coast, How long will it take for the impact of this conference to reach me? 9 months is the answer. It took 9 months for the bastards to reach me. Not because I have a watermelon on my keychain or because I tell everyone who will listen that Israel is committing a genocide that is worse than the Holocaust. No. The reason they canceled me was because they were scared of what I would expose when I spoke the truth about Christian Zionism. And it was easy to cancel me, because guess what? The mayor of Melbourne City Council was one of the suckers that spent 3 days in the Gold Coast being indoctrinated by a foreign entity. Although it's interesting to know that according to this comic strip that the Zionists made, they point to it being the CEO of the Melbourne City Council who made the decision. I can't emphasize this enough. Every Australian should be concerned about Israel interfering in our local councils. In the same way that every Australian should be concerned about Israel interfering in our universities, hospitals, schools, and cultural establishments. In the same way that every Australian should be concerned about a royal commission that is paving the way for racism, fascism, and bigotry to be amplified in our country, which in fact is the exact opposite of what this social cohesion claims to be. Now, why am I holding two grapefruits? Maybe some of you already know the symbolism, or you might be like me and miss this story. So I want to end with this, because the bastards want us to feel powerless, that there's nothing that we can do. We just have to sit back and watch the injustice unfold. And that is the biggest lie of all. Because each one of us has the potential to change the course of history. So here is the story of how two grapefruits changed the world. The story is set in Ireland in 1984, 42 years ago. A young woman named Mary Manning, just a regular 21-year-old checkout chick at the local shop. The union that she was part of had made a decision to listen to black South Africans who were asking for all South African goods to be boycotted, to pressure South Africa to end apartheid. Mary had never been to South Africa. In fact, Mary had never met a person of color before, but she understood that apartheid was wrong, which meant that when a customer arrived at her till carrying two South African grapefruits, Mary refused to handle them. She could have easily dismissed them as just two insignificant grapefruits, especially when it cost her her job. 10 other young women and one man joined Mary in a strike. Their strike lasted for over 2.5 years, and it sparked a global movement and directly led to Ireland becoming the first Western country to ban the import of all South African goods. In 1990, following his release, Nelson Mandela flew to Ireland and personally met with Mary and her grapefruit ladies to thank them for their defiance and their tireless commitment to justice. I'm sharing this story to highlight that boycotting works. It's powerful and effective and a non-violent way to bring a dangerous and racist government to its knees. Instead of feeling overwhelmed by Israel's interference here in Australia, let's be fired up to increase our boycotting and to become more strategic in our efforts, one little cut at a time. And hopefully, it won't be long until we see a free Palestine and the death of the Zionist regime.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, that's right. It finished completely fast. You're on you're on Solidarity Breakfast.
What a great song.
That was great.
Yeah, it was great to be. You were talking a little bit to us while the song on. How did you come across?
That's the one of the boys is the singers in one of my classes or was in one of my classes at Victoria University. That's Melbourne band The Takes. You can go see them playing live throughout this month. I think they got a residency at Bar Open, but you could just check their Instagram at The Takes.
Yeah, take Melbourne. That, AI. Take that.
Yeah, AI could never.
We should get back on with the show, but I heard some very haunting news this week. Apparently the top song in the ARIA's chart this week is an AI song.
Yes,
Oh my god!
I came across that. I came across that. It was actually a mix of Madonna.
Yeah,
song,
it was like a prayer.
Yeah,
and then with like an AI vocal.
Yeah,
and I just think if there was ever a reminder that we need to support local music, oh my god.
Well, maybe we'll make it a feature that the next few episodes will just play exclusively.
I think that's a great
That's a great
music.
Idea. Throw it our way. Satellite Skies is a program on 3CR. On the 13th of July, they race raged. She was speaking to Izzy bass Mama Brown and Desmond Bluton as they travel to the Convergence. The Convergence, which is going on at the moment towards Pine Gap. But this is their journey up, and this is a backgrounder to our next chat, which is going to give us a bit of an understanding of what the focus is for the Pine Gap Convergence and all those wonderful people who are making their way up there.
If anybody's been staying on top of what the Art of Resistance Tour have been doing on their way up to the closed Pine Gap Convergence, there's been a lot of direct actions at Roxby Downs, on Arabana Country, heading up there to protest against the US imperialist spy nightmare that is Pine Gap. We'll let Bass Womit and Des take it from here.
So, where are we and who are you and what are we doing?
I'm here at Mpatwe, Alice Springs, and my name is Desmond Blurton. I'm Deputy Chair of Des and Kelsey Watch Committee and also a climate activist.
Excellent. And what brings you to this part of the world?
There is genocidal monstrosities, and there are evil that is being played out today. We are here to stop that. We are here to stop the genocide. We are here to ask these people down in Pine Gap to remove themselves and go back home to where they belong in the US. Because our land never ceded, and no one gave these people permission to set up a base at Pine Gap which they kept as a secret all along. Kept it a secret from the public, saying that it was, but it was not. It was a secret base designed to inflict pain on the world. Free Palestine.
All right. And can you tell us a bit of the other stuff you've been up to lately?
Yeah, we've been up to some other stuff down in the uranium mine. We put a sacred fire out there. We can put our sacred fires wherever we like because this is our land and it's unceded. And I encourage any of the mob around here, if they want to light sacred fires, do it wherever you like. And if that is in front of a road, in front of a mine site, because the mines aren't doing anything, and especially this uranium mine at Olympic Dam, how dare they bring that material and bring it up to the top and use Arabuna water to extract the uranium. The Arabuna water down in Arabuna belongs to the Arabuna people. So I urge anyone to stop that uranium mine and cause as much as delays as we did in the art of resistance.
And after that, I think we cruised down to Woomera. Can you tell us a bit about what happened there?
Yeah, we went to Woomera military base and Woomera town. Well, I've put forward on behalf of the 300 nations that that name should be removed for our most powerful ancient culture, ancient instrument, and its symbolism. That is a spear launcher, not a rocket launcher. So us indigenous people, the 300 plus nation, don't want to be connected to any wars. So we would like our name removed from that place immediately. We demand it removed from there because we address the people at the front. And thank you, Izzy, for standing beside me. And we asked them questions, which none of them could not give us an answer to. When people are doing things secretly, that is a no. That is a big no, because no facility on this land should be kept from Aboriginal people, whether it's prisons, whether it's this military base. We should have access to any of these sites because they come to our sites and they destroy them. They come to our sites and they destroy them. It's so horrible to think that the military are assisting in genocidal acts. And we encourage the police, so-called police, to explain what's going on. They could not explain about why the military can't give us answers. They can explain. This is sovereign. This land wasn't ceded. Sovereignty wasn't ceded. So whatever they do on that day is illegal. And I would like everything down there shut down because that part is so military run, they keep it a big secret, which we don't like. And I'm glad I'm here to roll with the art of resistance, to fight for country, because I come from Borloo and there's a lot of country between here and there. And one grain of sand connects up all our tribes all over the land. So we must protect this land and water.
Beautiful. Thank you, Des.
No problem, Izzy. We stand as one.
Woo.
Your boy Race Rage, Jamaica Moana.
Hey, it's your boy Race Rage, and you're here on 8:55 a.m. on 3CR.
And you're back with Solidarity Breakfast. And thank you very much to Corinna for putting that piece together from Satellite Skies. We've got Tom Feiberg on the line. G'day, Tom. How are you?
Morning, Annie. Thanks for having me on. I'm well, thanks.
Yeah, and you're from Whitehorse for Palestine, and you wanted to talk to us a little bit about the Pine Gap convergence and the importance of it.
Absolutely. So I'm from Whitehorse, from Palestine. We're a Palestine solidarity group that's active out in the eastern suburbs. Our group covers areas between Blackburn, Box Hill, and Vermont South. And we've come together We're putting on an event in the afternoon later today that's put on to coincide with and in solidarity with the Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence that's been happening now over the weekend, and that's seeing hundreds of activists converge onto Pine Gap in Arrante Land in the Northern Territory to really talk about and highlight the role that Pine Gap, the U.S. spy base, is playing in the genocide that's unfolding in Gaza and in the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Lebanon and Iran, and to build some pressure to bring that and the U.S. alliance to an end. I should also say that action itself is being put on by Anti-Militarism Action Network and Embattoir for Palestine, as well as the local Arante people there are very much supporting that initiative as well.
The event that the rally that you've got on today, later in the day, Rosebank Engineering. Tell us about Rosebank Engineering and how it connects.
Absolutely. So for any listeners who are unaware, Rosebank Engineering in Melbourne's Outer East, part of North City Council, is a crucial business partner in the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program. That F-35 jet is the principal fighter jet used by the IOF and has come to be practically synonymous with Israel's genocide. And that's one that Rosebank is the sole supplier of what's known as the uplock actuator system, which is the system that opens and closes the weapon bay doors of those F-30 fighter jets, as well as being the sole supplier of this set of parts. It also manufactures approximately 150 other parts and also provides repair and maintenance for the jet there as well. So if this was to, you know, stop happening at Rosebank, that would make a tangible impact on Israel's ability to conduct a genocide that has killed at least 70,000 Palestinians, as well as of which a large number are women and children. The way that I guess that ties into the convergence is I guess that is the U.S. alliance, and particularly in the way that jet is developed and assembled by U.S. Weapons Corporation, Lockheed Martin. And the role that the U.S., I guess, plays in distributing that and the critical backing it essentially plays for Israel. So the Rosebank ties Victoria and particularly ties all the eastern suburb into that genocide and into U.S.-Israeli crimes.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, this idea that we could pretend that Australia isn't actively involved. The convergence in Pine Gap is the key, but all these other satellite industries tying Australia into the US military industrial complex. It was announced that Penny Wong was uncomfortable about the Chinese doing a ballistic missile test recently, but they are being disingenuous, aren't they, the Australian government, in relation to the connection that Australia has directly to the US empire building process.
Absolutely, and I mean, we've heard all the lies about non-lethal parts, all the parts that they're providing are absolutely lethal. There's no other way about it. And the other thing that's been the case since 2011 is Australia's contribution of something like $78 million in grants to the 70 weapons companies that litter our continent, of which half was actually awarded after October 7, 2023, and of which Rosebank Engineering actually received the lion's share as well. So there's a real sense in which Rosebank is a key component to this genocide and is happening under the auspices of both local, state, and federal governments here.
Now, for people who can't be at the convergence, and there are people from here who are part of the convergence, as we've heard before we started to talk to Tom, tell people about the details for this rally today.
Absolutely. So the rally today is happening at 2 p.m. at 836 Mountain Highway in Bayswater. It's a community rally that's, like I said, put on with a, by a coalition of Palestine solidarity groups in the east, principally Knox for Palestine, Whitehorse for Palestine, Menzies and Dandenong for Palestine. And it will be a family-friendly event with a range of speakers, including someone from the Anti-Militarism Action Network, that will be about highlighting the role that Rosebank plays and building the community pressure to actually end that, to cut Australia's ties with Israel and stop manufacturing these weapons parts through Rosebank engineering. We're proud to have an official from the AMWU, the Metal Workers Union, speak on that platform as well. I think looking at what's happened in Italy and Spain with the general strikes of Palestine, there's a key importance of having a union and an official for a union that represents some of those workers at those weapons factories speaking on the platform as a way of, you know, trying to build that connection and that relationship with the workers there who ultimately have quite a lot of power to stop that if they have that confidence that they can have the backing of the union to do that.
Thank you very much for talking to us today, Tom.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
A weak solidarity, Bricky Team listener, when it became apparent I, economically blinkered, just can't see the big picture, the rapidly spreading damage of policies whose consequences the ignorant perpetrators can't envisage, unlike the expert practitioners of the greatest little economic order of them all, comprehending the delicate bit of the delicate flower that is the economy. Expressed wisely by Minerals Profits Council Supremo Tania Con the Worker Stable Profits, as evil unions and lazy avaricious workers in the Pilbara take industrial action, that is, strike against their caring employers. The big Aussie of which we're all so proud, BHP, bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, all down to the out-of-control socialist government. The Pilbara evil union free for decades and now faced with, well, let's hear Tania. Government policy and unnecessary industrial action risk ruining the winning formula that has worked so well for everyone. Not sure who she includes in everyone, but obviously it's been win-win for decades. Although if it's been so good for workers, win-win, what are they worried about? Tania explained that the socialist industrial relations reforms in parentheses, risk spreading poisonous CFMEU-style unionism across the entire economy. Poisonous, the entire economy. Can we think of anything worse? Spreading like red-hot rampant lava from the Pilbara across the entire continent. Verified by that reliable oracle, the True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review editorial, after big Supremo Anthony Albanese attempted to ease the spreading economic pain, warning the evil unions not to abuse their privileges. Oh yes, they're so privileged. It's hypocritical, the Capitalist Review spoke for all sensible thinkers, given that he has given them the keys to the iron ore kingdom. The keys to the kingdom. Snatched them off bloody Huge and Gina and Twitty and Santosus the Prophets and Woodside with Prophets et al. Poor, impoverished, caring employers. The poor dears face economic disaster week after week. Can anyone talk some sense into the evil unions? On matters of resources and energy, my word, the caring business class, hayseed and sheepshed parties coalition lot are slow learners, aren't they? Their fossil pollution spokesperson, Dan T. and Radioactive Biscuits, still says nuclear energy, those small modular reactors they keep talking about, without mentioning the small problem that they don't actually exist, are the answer to what they don't consider a problem in the first place, the climate change they know doesn't exist. We wonder why they bother. the government Yellow Cake Dan assured us would ensure their safety. Thanks, Dan, just like His Most Gracious Majesty's home country and the US of the UN of the US of the world and Russia and Japan et al. Have guaranteed. Uranium-powered data centers just everywhere. Utopia. And Dan knows what he's talking about. He's just returned from an all-expenses-paid luxury tour of London, Oslo and Munich discussing energy issues, funded by a bloke called Charles Kiefel, a huge uranium advocate and, more importantly, exporter, who also funded a Dan trip to the US of last year, putting him up in a little $1,800-a-night luxury hotel in Washington. So Dan's getting the real picture. The socialist refusal to adopt nuclear energy is Luddite, dragging true blue Aussie into the dark ages, Dan announced from his $1,800 suite. Well, they are planning to import US of nuclear waste and pack lots of uranium off to India. That's something, Dan. Luxury. Antonita Cataldo is an 88-year-old Italian nun who so loves the dear baby Jesus she founded the Institute of the Missionary Sisters of Mercy to assist former prisoners and young mothers. What a caring woman. And no doubt the dear baby Jesus just loves her in return, a bride of Christ, who urged the faithful to donate money and very, very expensive items, else disaster would befall them. Now, not sure how much of the money and very expensive items the former prisoners and young mums saw, but authorities found more than $3 million tucked away in the Vatican Bank and other banks in the good sisters' accounts. Poor Sister Antonita has been charged with defrauding the vulnerable. What thanks for saving all those vulnerables from spiritual disaster? Also in Italy, down in Sicily, our very own filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, was spied in her upmarket swimwear by a pool at the upmarket Grand Hotel San Pietro in Taormina, presumably trying to take her mind off losing the keys to the Iron Ore Kingdom. And who's that also there paying homage to Gina? Why, it's Run Notions, that appalling Hoonson. See, Gina's favourite upmarket Italian fashion label was holding a four-day, quote, fashion showcase for invited upmarket guests like Gina. That appalling was just a blow-in or fly-in, and soon as that appalling came to pay homage to her hero, Gina jetted off in her new 150 million real figure, 150 million private jet, for Nice to soak up a bit of the French Riviera, then on to a little pad at Mar-a-Lago, so she could pay homage to her hero, US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump the Poor, who constantly pays homage to his hero, Donald Trump the Poor. Wonder if that appalling hung around in Taormina, sitting just beneath Mount Etna, which regularly erupts and creates a bit of havoc, we can only hope. The good holy Sister Antonita's extortion pales against Donald's threat to extort huge sums for the world's shipping to transit the Strait of Hormuz. Interesting that when evil Iran started charging much less, Donald's Secretary for World State Mario Rubout Cubario declared it was illegal. Then the Don changed his mind, or had it changed for him, telling us the Gulf states were desperate to invest lots and lots of lovely, lovely money in Trump Inc. In the US of. Interesting how the economy works. Not so surprising news a couple of weeks ago that Donald has made massive profits, upwards of 700 mil, from his crypto coin rort, venture, yet about a million investors lost about 5.5 billion. Funny that. That appalling had a friendly chit-chat online with another of her heroes, Britain's number one fascist. So extreme, even reform fascism UK Nigel Farage the depths eschews him, although probably for pragmatic political reasons, because we can't see a hell of an ideological gap between them. But Nigel runs away with the Logic of the Week award. Mentioned last week, he's resigned his seat to run again after being sprung not declaring millions in money and kind donations. Appropriate, we suggested his only opponent is likely to be a garbage bin. But the logic bit? Well, Nige says if the electorate re-elects him, it will prove he didn't do what he did do. Nige, you've got a fair bit of ground to make up in the logic department. Oh, and the government says if he wins, it will be back to square one anyway. An inquiry into the donation scandal saying he did do what he says the wind will show he didn't do, even though he did do. Sensible way to waste money on an unnecessary by-election. In her friendly online chat with her fascist friend, that appalling fingered the beginning of the end of the white troubler Aussie policy, which itself, of course, was launched by the arrival of the No Proper Papers queue-jumping illegal boat people in 1788. White troubler Aussie policy, which led to that appalling's moron culture. But it wasn't just the elite, the filthiest rich, being spotted in luxury retreats. Exciting news for the working class. Two working class heroes, former big supremo Julia Gallinghard and former secretary of that out-of-control militant union, the AWU, definitely not an evil union, Paul How's the Other Half Live. Paul, of course, took the working class struggle to one of the big four money machines, KP on the workers MG, and then took over another financial advisory mob after its founder, Luke Sayers, ran into a bit of trouble over that so-called Dick Pick incident. Well, Julia and Paul took their ongoing battle for the working class too. Yes, they were photographed seated together at Wimbledon in the Royal Box. Isn't that exciting news for all workers? And no doubt they discussed the struggles of the working class with the other invitees and royals in the box. And what a generous person that Wendy McMillan, real name, who's just taken over as supremo of Port Pirie and Hobart smelter operator Nyrstar, suffering a bit financially. Big-hearted Wendy announced this week she is open to a taxpayer-funded bailout. We have to admire such generosity from the caring business class, which knows government has no role in the private sector, other than the odd trillion or two of corporate welfare. And they're also upset that the budget has made changes to the R&D, research and development, corporate welfare, warning this will force tech companies to flee True Blue Aussie. Now, if Nyrstar and the tech companies and all the others are involved in the greatest little economic order of them all, and fervent believers in market forces and laissez-faire, and the R&D will help them make even more money, having a bit of trouble seeing why the public purse should fund any of it. But that's where we started, ignorant of how the delicate flower works. Like the witch bank which used to be our bank, well, the big four generally. The evil union says they're slashing jobs but advertising for the same jobs in Asia. Silly, evil union nonsense about lower wages and conditions, as if they'd do that. And finally, while the hurt screeching continues unabated that the budget will destroy the economy and especially small business, that backbone of the economy, figures this week show small business owes the tax department, that is the public purse, $100 billion. And that's the bits they can't hide, obviously. That's one way around the problem. Just don't pay them. Good morning. Dinier,
this is Birrigan from Woolagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Goombanga Country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Kevin. I messed up the last bit. I've been having a struggle with the mouse here on the program today. It doesn't want to do what it's supposed to do, but every so often it does it right. It's a bit disturbing. But anyway, Solidarity Breakfast is coming to its end once more, and we're going to finish up with an interview I did with Brenna Dempsey and David Gonzalez. Brenna is a delegate of the ETU at the Monash branch, and David Gonzalez is the Uni Melbourne branch president, and they're running for the leadership of the National Tertiary Education Union, part of branches lead group, who want the branches to lead the union's direction. And this is the chat they had with me. This is very important stuff for workers. Here we are today talking to David and Brenna. Now, you're putting yourselves forward for election with the NTU.
We are running for election with the NTU in the Victorian division. So the Victorian division covers all of the university branches and the TAFE branches in Victoria, and we are running for the division assistant secretary. That's what I'm running for, and David is running for the division secretary role.
We're running under the branches lead banner is our ticket.
Brennan and I have been working in our branches, Brennan at Monash and me at University of Melbourne for years now. And we've been building branches that are based on member empowerment and building real power in our workplaces. And we've had some amazing successes in our branches doing that. And we basically want to bring that to the rest of the state. And in our union, that's called the division. We have very clear ideas about that our union needs to be led from the branches, not from the central office. A lot of the issues that we want to work on and deal with really are about how do we put the structures in place to have proper delegate structures and people in as many workplaces as we can across the higher education sector in Victoria.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Melbourne University, we'll start there as a case study, has indeed had some wonderful wins for its members. And it's won because the challenges have been so great and the membership have been so staunch.
Correct. The funny thing about this election, I think, is that where someone put a comment on social media that our union for the first time has the beautiful problem of two left candidates. Mm. And we all come from the same sort of fight. I was recruited by a woman who was a leader of the Casuals campaign at Melbourne Uni. That's how I got first involved. So all of this excitement and change across the Victorian division really comes from that spark that happened at that Casuals campaign in Melbourne, and what we were able to build in terms of bargaining in the last round of bargaining to really bring thousands of people into secure work could not have happened if that campaign hadn't started. And now we're seeing the dividends of it, and hopefully it changes our union nationally as well.
Yeah. And so, Brenna, what comparisons can you make with what's happened at Monash and what happened at Melbourne?
I think one of the things that happened at Monash that's really big that you and I have spoken about before, Annie, is our wage theft court case win that we had. That wage theft was discovered by rank and file members, by members of our union, and they brought it together collectively and they brought it to senior leadership and we did something about it. And we are now fighting again around that. It's 12 months since that determination was made and we still haven't seen payments come through to those affected. That's a whole nother kettle of fish that I can get into. But I think that one of the things that shows is that was something that our members discovered, and our members are our union. And it's the same with the stories that David is telling. These are not things that have happened because paid members of staff or senior leadership have discovered them and magically fixed them. That's not how it works. It works because the members see an issue, they raise an issue, they come together, they work together, and they solve it collectively. And that's the sort of leadership that David and I want to inspire, and we want to do more of that. And we want to make sure that those members who see those issues and who want to do something feel that they have the voice to do that, and that they're not shut down in any way, and that they have people behind them who will make that happen.
The universities, which are public spaces, have been overtaken by a neoliberal assault from, I'd say, the 1980s. It's been a considerable attack on what was a public space for excellence in intellectual pursuit, but it's become muddied. And part of that is that it's top-heavy now, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. It's top-heavy. The people at the top are paid significantly more than the people at the bottom, which is something that we see in, you know, corporate America, but is happening here in our own universities as well. And I think that there's a real disconnect between the vice-chancellors and chancellors and people at those executive levels and the everyday workers in the university. And I think we are also starting to see that shift coming about in our union as well, and that's really scary to me. I don't want us to feel like our rank-and-file members are separate or disconnected in any way from the leaders that are supposedly there to support them and to encourage them and to foster their own leadership and growth within that group.
David, the thing about the lower pay and the casualisation of the sector, when in actual fact people have to expend an enormous amount of personal resources as well as financial resources to be able to actually get a master's, a doctorate, to be able to climb the greasy pole of academia. There seems to be some sort of disconnect between how your members and the university itself. It's almost like you have to win the university back. Would I be going too far when I say that? I mean, that the members themselves of your union and the workers at the universities need to tell the Boswellers that what are universities for?
Yeah, the centre of power is completely in management's court at this point. One of the things I just want to point out is that, you know, our union is made up of professional staff, the people who support the university and academic staff. So it's not just academic staff that we represent. So we have people who are, what I love about the NTEU is that in a university space, we are often, as professional staff, which is what I am at the Faculty of Fine Arts and Music at the University of Melbourne, the old VCA, you know, we are subservient in a lot of people's minds to academics. And within our union, we have an equal voice. And I think a lot of those ideas about how we recenter that gravity back towards workers in our universities, a lot of those ideas are coming from professional staff as well.
Actually, it's one of the things that I found really shocking was to find out that the library people lost their tea room because it was decided that they didn't need a tea room at the library. And I thought, wow, this university is really sinking to the bottom of the heap. Which, I mean, they're professional staff, effectively, aren't they?
They are.
They are.
Yeah, one of our most active parts of our membership at Melbourne. And in fact, I think across all of our union.
Yeah, definitely at Monash too. Yeah. I think that the other thing that's important to add is that we don't just cover universities in our union. We cover TAFE and we cover research institutes and other smaller bodies as well. And I think that one of the things that we notice within our union is not only do we speak about academics and we speak about professional staff, but we also then sort of forget that there are other members that we support as well. There's also
potential members
as well. Correct.
We want a growing union that represents the entire higher education sector, not just Melbourne and Monash, right? For too long, that's been the focus of.
So that this separation between rural universities as well as, I mean, because the decentralisation of the education system, which happened during Whitlam a long time ago. It's almost like people have to struggle to continue that to be like the TAFEs down in, you know, country areas and all those kind of things. You're talking about everybody, aren't you?
In that we actually represent private providers as well. A lot of, you know, people, Call Arts is a private provider and they're covered by the NTEU. So people are being educated in different ways, and we want a union that integrates all of those voices into one place.
How do you go about doing that, though? How do you make sure that your members are being heard? You know, tell your members how you think that could happen.
I mean, I think for me, I have a particular focus on TAFE because that's where I started when I got into education. I worked at Melbourne Polytechnic, and I understand how challenging it is being in a TAFE and also to feel in some ways forgotten and slightly unloved by your own union is difficult. That was my personal experience when I was at Melbourne Polytechnic. I've been speaking to TAFE members across Victoria about the issues that they're facing. I actually was speaking to some members from Go TAFE, and there's a merger happening at the moment between two TAFEs in Northern Victoria that I don't believe anyone knows is actually happening, and the merger has gone through and those members have dealt with that on their own. These are rank and file elected members up there. So that was shocking to me to hear that. So I think that the like widespread membership that we have shouldn't be a barrier to supporting them. We've all learned through COVID that we can interact on Zoom. And I think that that's one of the ways that we need to be engaging with these members better. I think there are also inherent structures in our elected leadership that means that those people don't have a voice. I understand the democratic nature of that the number of members you have in an area warrants more elected representatives, but also if we don't have the members to begin with, how do we get an elected rep to then ensure those voices are heard?
Part of this starts with just having leadership that reflects the membership, right? Like, we're never going to just one day magically have all of those people at the table. It's a vast sector, but we have to start somewhere, right? Having two professional staff people, an incredibly underrepresented cohort within our union, running for the top positions in our state, our issues are going to be heard at that table. And the work that we've done, at Melbourne, the professional staff for this round of bargaining put 4-day work week for professional staff on the table, right? That's not something that academics would have put on the table if we didn't have that voice. And I think the same thing goes with TAFE and private providers. And the simple answer is organizing. And we just need to get out there and be having those conversations and recruiting those members and making sure that they know they have a place at the table that is the NTU.
I think also, in addition to that, as a woman standing, it's really important to me that we hear women's voices. The average union member in Australia is a 45-year-old woman, probably in a caring industry. And I think that, I was at the women's conference for the NTU on Friday, and we were talking about how nationally our membership is 60% women and 40% men, but we don't see that reflected in our leadership position.
I always think that's really weird.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's terribly weird.
And to extend that, I'm a queer person of color and first person with those identities at President of Melbourne. And, I think you just see when someone sees themselves reflected in the leadership that, the comfort in calling you when there's a problem or the comfort in calling you when there's a celebration. That's also the we always forget about the fun part of unionism, right? Like, the togetherness and the excitement for our wins. So, yeah, I think, again, that sort of hearing those different voices is so important.
What are your views on the biggest challenges? Because we hear a whole range of things, and I know I have certain opinions about from the outside of what's going on in the universities and the TAFEs. They're incredibly important places for the workers and our society. Their focus seemed to be business-focused rather than society-focused in some ways.
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes to mind when you speak about that is our recent report on class sizes. So, we are in the business of educating students, and I use that word business, which is ironic because I don't think we should be a business, but that's the language that we use. We're seeing detrimental class sizes at the moment, and that's impacting our students. And our students should be the focus of the way that we work as higher education professionals and academics. And I think that we and our senior management, I think, are also losing sight of that. I think that we've forgotten that we're in the business of education and that needs to be one of the key features of the way that we work.
Because we're really in the business of real estate at the moment.
Correct.
Mm. I mean, I'm going back to the academics. They're changing to terms, and they're doing things like reducing people's dependence on research and becoming purely teachers, which basically is changing the nature of what a university is. I don't really understand how they can get away with it. And I've always wondered why the students themselves don't litigate against universities for poor performance.
That's the student union.
You'll have to, yeah.
They have their own union.
They have their own union.
They do.
That's just an aside.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, if they're going to have a business model, then...
All of these things go back to getting that center right around who has control, right? We have burnout across professional staff and academic staff. And it's not because of some lack of resiliency that we have, right?
It's overwork.
And it's with no real input into how that work should be designed. Mm. And when we have managers on $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year salaries dictating what a level A academic is doing in a classroom, they haven't been in a classroom for a very long time.
If ever.
If ever. And so that's why getting that balance on the governance of the universities and having greater voice at those tables is incredibly important.
That's what you're aiming for. Once you're elected, that's what you're aiming for, and that's what the NTU would be pushing for.
Well, it's funny, you know, as you said, as we talked about earlier, our ticket is called Branches Lead. And to me, that's a question for each branch. We're set up as a union a little bit differently than most unions. You know, usually the branches are the state level. The core of our union really is what we call branches, which is are the individual universities or TAFE or, the, you know, these different areas. I very much believe in not dictating what's going to be the most important thing for your branch. What I think our job will be is helping facilitate those good ideas to be able to run a winning campaign in workplaces. This is actually my third time running for a statewide office at NTU, and I've seen it over and over again. You see the other people campaigning for these grand ideas, and it's like, that might be a good idea, but that's not what has been decided at a branch level. So why are we cutting those people out of it? I have my own visions about what I would love to see, but I don't think that's what the job is.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
I agree. I think it's about amplifying the voices of our members. They all have their own ideas about what would work, and they might be better ideas than our ideas. And I think also we can improve the communication that exists between the branches as well, because there might be something that's happening at Deakin that's great that only members at Deakin know about. And if we share that idea and it works at another branch, then that's great. We should be utilizing the skills and the knowledge that exists within those branches as well.
What's funny about our union is that we actually have all of these structures to do all of that already. You know, we have a division. I'm the president of the division council in Victoria. So that's the all of the branches come together and we meet, I think, 5 or 6 times a year. And that is that space. And we have these individual branches that have their own branch committees. My dream for our union is to actually, for the first time, actually run it the way it was is designed. Because we, I don't think we need to bring in new ideas. Like, let's try like using what we have already.
And what do you think gets in the way of that? Other people's agendas or outside forces?
Other people's agendas. I won't get into this deeply, but I mean, you probably know that, you know, our union was essentially the vision of a single person. And so I think a lot of things play out from the kind of the personality of that person. And so I think to be a leader in the union previously, you sort of had to
either be the big man or the big woman.
And usually the big,
big man.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people are sort of into this idea of you've got the motoring cap on, you must know what to do. But in actual fact, the answer is in all the people that are having difficulties at work and then discovering that they're not the only ones who've got that same difficulty.
I think that's true. I think that also there's a sort of a disconnect from some of those people that David is speaking about from their own experiences of being a rank and file member.
If ever, yes.
There's a separation there that exists that I think means they don't know internally what's going on, and for whatever reason they are afraid to find out as well. So, you know, David was saying that we have these structures in place already that could be working in the way that we envisage, but they're not, and they're currently existing as a report back structure that is top down. And
selective report back even.
Correct, yes. And it's not transparent and it doesn't go down to the members. It doesn't get disseminated in any way.
And there could easily be change make the union more effective. You've started your campaign. Are you finding it difficult to get to all the members, or what's your strategy?
It is difficult to get to all the members.
The rules of our organization is that you don't get access to anything other than the list of members that's provided by the AEC, which is a very limited because of the Howard rules. I think it is that, you know, all of our elections are run by the Election Commission by postal ballot. The barriers are just like crazy high to try to reach people.
Especially for us as rank and file members as well.
Yeah. So my strategy personally is, so I'm the branch president at Melbourne, and I'm the chair of the bargaining team there. And really the core of my strategy is to be doing a good job in my job. And hopefully members notice that. They know me, but it's the largest branch in the country now. We've grown 20-something% since I've been branch president. That's what we have. And then it's the traditional, social media now and speaking to people like you and just making sure people know who we are and what it is that makes us different, which is that we're real members.
And that is David and Brenna, who are running for... Oh, she's gone away. Why? I thought I had Lucy there waiting to talk to us. Lucy, we'll be back in a minute. No. Well, Lucy, we don't have enough time to even get her back, I have to say.
For everyone that wondered why we got Lucy from Nibs on, is because today is the Big Red Book Fair.
That's right, big... Big.
So today you will have been saving since last year.
Yeah, that's right.
And putting your money aside because they've pulled out some amazing books from the archive. So from 10 a.m. today at Trades Hall, you'll be able to go pick up some incredible books from the archives that are not usually accessible at the New International Bookshop because of their shop being so small. I've been told that there's an exceptional...
No need to roast them, Toby.
Well, I mean, it's a beautiful shop, but it's... Can't house this collection, but...
How big are these red books?
Well,
are they
going
to be able to take them
They're
home?
Big, man.
Are
They're
we
going
to be able to take them home? Or
yeah, you will be able to. Or? Well, for anyone that's interested in Italian books, Italian political history, there's going to be quite a lot.
There will
Apparently,
be?
Apparently, there'll be quite a lot.
There
so,
will be.
Yeah, come down just so you can say hello to Matthew. Matthew will be there.
I might have to bring a truck.
And what else have we got today, Matthew? What are you presenting later today?
Yes.
You better present it.
Yeah, I'll be emceeing and officiating it. We're at the Darebin Ethnic Communities Council, which I am secretary and public officer. We'll be holding the Migrant Workers Forum and Know Your Rights. It will be a presentation given by Gabi Pashos, who's a bicultural work ambassador with the Migrant Workers Centre. And it will also be followed by a guest speaker, Massimo Colosi, who'll be speaking of his lived experience of as a migrant, as also experiencing workplace exploitation in the hospitality industry, and he'll be speaking of positive
All right, so now, what's the time?
It is at 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Darebin Intercultural Centre at High Street in Preston.
And Perfect. While you're north side tonight, you can hear the Takes play at the Cactus Room, 8 p.m. with supports MEU and Legroom. We'll go out with their song Shoot Me Down.
These girls, I can't explain it. This body's free, occupied, starting up a paycheck, and nothing is changing. It's time to raise the glass to this city that I love so.
dear.